Hello and welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. This episode is part of a special mini-series produced in collaboration with Bloomberg Businessweek, bringing you sustainable finance and leadership for a changing world. I'll be hearing from some of the thought leaders speaking at the Bloomberg Businessweek Good Business Festival held at The Conduit on topics including clean air, the future of energy, reimagining cities, and sustainable supply chains.
80% of all carbon emissions are coming from cities. And that's only set to increase as more and more people move, still inexorably, towards cities. So if we're going to tackle climate change, it's absolutely critical that cities are at the heart of that, and indeed taking a leadership role.
My guest today is Harriet Lam, CEO of Ashton. Harriet joined Ashton as CEO in May of this year, taking responsibility for the organization's ambitious new strategy to tackle climate change. Harriet has always worked for NGOs with a focus on international development, peace, and the environment, including being CEO of International Alert and spending 15 years leading fair trade in the UK and globally. Her book, Fighting the Banana Wars and Other Fair Trade Battles, was published in 2008, and she was awarded a CBE in 2006. Harriet, welcome.
Hello, Paul. Lovely to be here at The Conduit.
We're so lucky to have you. I'd like to ask you about your childhood. You lived in India as a child, you went abroad, and then you returned. How has that experience shaped your approach to climate, sustainability, development, peace building, and any of those subjects?
Yes, I think it was probably the formative experience. Because I'd lived in India as a child, that meant I went back when I was 18, went back when I was 22, and then have lived there. And I think because of that, I felt very strongly that we absolutely can make poverty history, that there are terrible inequalities and poverty existing globally, and that we have it within our capacity to end that, and that my responsibility as someone who's British is to be part of changing the global structures of trade and finance that actually keep people and countries in poverty. And I was also really inspired during my time working with NGOs in India, working in the rural villages, people who really had deep within them the Gandhian philosophy of live the change you want to see in the world. And I think that really inspired me all my life, is to look to find those actions that we can all take ourselves as individuals that will help in the end create the structural changes that we need to see. Which is why, for example, fair trade was for me such an inspiring example, because we can all buy fair trade tea and coffee or bananas and therefore make sure the farmers and workers get a fair price. And that's something we can live out every day.
So I'm interested in that because fair trade is a globally recognized both brand and mark and, dare I say it, movement. And it's predicated on consumers making everyday choices that then begin to produce structural change. And so it empowers consumers and places the power of change in their hands. And tell me about the other part of that, which is other kinds of structural change that need to be made in order to achieve justice. Because on the one level, consumers have an important role to play, but who are the other constituent elements of making important, long-lasting structural change?
Well, if consumers change, that will drive change from companies. So if the customer's always right when they say they want good value, then they're also right when they say they want the producers to be treated fairly. So by consumers demanding fair trade and then buying those products when companies made them available, they have been able to drive the big positive changes that companies need to make. Because companies absolutely can help address inequality globally, but it also really helps them if they know not only is it the right thing to do, but actually their customers will welcome it and reward them and reward their brands. So first and foremost, I think companies absolutely have to change. But then so too, of course, do governments, and so does government regulation. And clearly, in the end, that will always be the most critical determining factor. Trade, for example, is absolutely run by regulation between nation states. And actually, currently, you're not allowed under World Trade Organization rules to discriminate between products on the basis of the way they're produced. And that's absolutely terrible, because that holds back the ability of regulation to help insist upon justice in trade. And so we always saw fair trade exactly as a movement that would show what was possible, but would then drive those bigger changes, both from companies and finally from government.
So as you can hear from the background noise, we're at the Conduit, and we're doing a conference on good business together with Bloomberg Business Week. And you are here talking in your capacity as the CEO of Ashton. So first, for those who don't know, tell us a little bit about what Ashton is and what it does.
Yes, well, it is indeed, as you can hear, lovely and buzzy here at the Conduit, with people talking about how we're going to tackle climate change. And that's what Ashton seeks to put the spotlight on. We seek to highlight the innovative solutions to climate change that do exist. I think at the moment, people are finally too late, but nonetheless, all of us are beginning to wake up to the scale of the crisis that we face in the world. And sometimes that can be just completely overwhelming, and it just feels so big that people almost put in a box and go away and go back to normal life. And that's where Ashton can play a critical role in actually showcasing all the incredible solutions that are out there, where people are already showing what is possible, and that we need to take those existing solutions and take them to scale. So let me give you one example from actually not that far away down the road in South London, is a social enterprise called Repowering that was set up exactly to involve people, normally marginalised people living on difficult estates in South London, and enabling them to learn about renewable energy, to learn about how you make solar panels, to put them on their buildings. And then from there, Repowering have then gone on to work with people to build energy gardens, they call them, to grow vegetables, but powered by solar energy. And in fact, in a wonderful example, they've then gone on to grow hops on some of the energy gardens and near train stations, and actually have produced a craft beer. I've actually brought you one, Paul, because I thought you might like it as a present. And perhaps you could start stocking it in the bar here. It's Energy Garden Ale, a new craft ale coming from these kind of community initiatives. They're an Ashton winner, but critically for me, they're an example of the ways in which people can come together to create good businesses that will create jobs for marginalised people and will tackle climate change. And I think at Ashton, we believe it always has to have those other benefits for people. So to give you another example of an Ashton winner who we awarded this year was Waltham Forest. If you hop on the tube and go up north from the Conduit Club, come to Waltham Forest, where they invested in an integrated transport system with closing off roads, encouraging people to walk, to cycle. And through that, amazingly, they've reduced air pollution such that babies born in the borough after this 2013, when they started an initiative, are expected to live already 6 weeks longer, according to research by King's College. And that again is another example of how we need to find the innovations that will benefit people themselves, people who are so pressurized and care first and foremost about their families. And if they see that their family can get a job, that their family's health can be improved, and that those same initiatives benefit climate change, then they'll stick with them and get behind them and give the mandate to those companies or those local authorities to take the next step, the next step, the next step. And going back to what we were saying about regulation, in the end, that's what you need, because you have to build a mandate for the big, difficult decisions that government have got to make. Otherwise, we'll end up with the kind of backlash that we've seen in places like Gilets Jaunes in France or elections in Australia or US.
So I guess the connection between all of this is the Livable Cities program that you've developed out of Ashton, and you've begun to give examples of how entrepreneurs have sought to make what are otherwise hard urban environments more habitable, but perhaps more sustainable and more equitable too. Tell us about this initiative.
80% of all carbon emissions are coming from cities. And that's only set to increase as more and more people move, still inexorably, towards cities. So if we're going to tackle climate change, it's absolutely critical that cities are at the heart of that, and indeed taking a leadership role. And cities very often do pride themselves on having strong leadership and on having strong identities. And I think we can use that to help drive the changes we need to see. But what we found was that actually cities are very often overwhelmed. And they now, half of all local authorities in Britain have actually declared a climate emergency. So that's not just cities, it's beyond. But it's half of all local authorities, and ticking up every day, have declared a climate emergency. And then many of them are looking at each other and thinking, well, what do we do now? And we discovered that actually even the sustainability officers aren't necessarily talking to each other or sharing best practice. So what we did was we talked to those sustainability officers, we talked to people working up and down the countries in cities to take steps toward climate change and put it into a toolkit, which has just been flying off the shelf, because local authorities are looking for those solutions. They don't have time actually to go back to the drawing board and reinvent from the beginning. They want to take the best examples that have already been tried and tested, whether it's in Liverpool or in the West Midlands or on Teesside, to take those ideas that are out there already and scale them up. And so we've really found a huge appetite across the country actually for learning from the innovative companies, the social enterprises, the charities who are doing great work, and the other local authorities, and really seeing how can we translate that into the kind of transformative change we need, whether it's in transport or whether it's in jobs or in health, and take that to the level that's required while still taking the public with us.
Give us an example or two of some of the most inspiring innovations that you've come across and which you're encouraging other cities to perhaps adopt.
Well, I have to say, one of the most inspiring for me, which is not from Britain, was actually from Colombia. It's the city of Medellin, famous as the homicide capital of the world. And yet in Medellin, they still managed to give a priority to say, we've just got to cool the city down. It's heating up and up, heating up. And so they came with this idea of growing green corridors throughout the city. So they took the rubbish dump and the back alleys where you would not go for fear of your life, frequented by the drugs and the gangs, and they took those areas and they trained local people to become gardeners, and they've planted thousands of trees and hundreds of thousands of shrubs in these corridors, which have now been transformed into areas where you can cycle around the city, where there are playgrounds, where mums hang out chatting while their kids are playing. And as a consequence, they brought down the temperature in those areas by 2 to 3 degrees. Now, I think that's a brilliant example. And if they can do it in Medellin with all the problems that they've got, come on, guys, we can do that in some of our cities here in Britain.
Amazing.
And actually, someone said to me when I was telling this story to some people in the City of London, you could see the light going on in their eyes as they thought about the sight lines which run throughout London, so you can always see St. Paul's, even from as far away as Richmond Park. What if we could take the sight lines and green them? How exciting would that be?
Tell us a little bit about the interface between sustainability and preservation, because I think there might be an interesting tension in keeping the historic value of cities and helping us preserve their history and their culture, which is something that we should care about, but also this urgent need to transform them to meet the urgency of the challenges today. And if you're a local government or a planning authority, having to try and figure out whether you put solar panels on the top of gorgeous historical buildings and perhaps make them less beautiful but more productive, it might be a hard decision. Have you thought about that or had to grapple with that?
Yes, we have grappled with that. I guess, could you call it innovative preservation? Yeah. Somehow finding a way of preserving the best of the past. And as you say, so many of our great cities, absolutely, their whole identity is built about around the past with the best of the future, if you like, with the best of utopia and how we can completely reimagine and preserve that critical cultural identity of each city, each of which is different. And when we grappled with that, actually, we first set up a network called Fit for the Future, exactly with key members like the National Trust or people like the Pickwell Foundation, who are thinking about this every day. How can they preserve ancient buildings, but in a way that builds for the future and puts sustainability front and centre? And so I think there is an enormous amount that we can do, and inspiring examples where people are achieving that already. But never preserving an aspect, because actually also culture is so critical to most cities. And there are so many people working in the cultural sphere and thinking also about how can we talk in the arts, in our art and our drama and our dance, about the scale of the challenges that we face with climate change. And indeed, it's because of that leading role of artists that I would say the Arts Council was very, very early to say that people receiving their grants had to take steps to improve the sustainability of their buildings. And that, I think that's a brilliant example. And it's a shame it hasn't yet been copied so much, both by other funders or indeed around the world.
You participated in the panel on reimagining cities today during our festival on the role of business. What was the most interesting or surprising thing that you learnt or heard or said on that panel?
Well, it definitely wasn't anything I said. I think the most difficult issue we were struggling with is how do you get the right balance between top-down regulation, which we need rules and laws if we're going to get to net zero by 2030, which is really what it needs to be. The government set a target of 2050. Frankly, that's going to be too late. If we're going to get there in time, we need fast-paced action of the level that, as one of the panelists mentioned, the Chinese government can do. How do you combine that with the need for bottom-up engagement of citizens, which is all too often then the casualty if you have top-down regulation? So I think the most difficult piece is how do we combine the two of all the time giving that right regulatory framework, which will then encourage finance and businesses to go in a particular direction, but we're also enabling the flourishing of 1,000 different initiatives, because every community needs a different, every city's different, and going back to what you were saying about preserving the uniqueness of each city, you've then got to do it in a way that's right for that place and that locality and their needs. And the needs of a Mumbai or a Rome, a London, New York, they're all different. And you've critically got to engage communities in that process so that they stick with it, see the benefits of action, not only because it's preventing devastating climate change, but also because they see the benefits in their own lives, that their health is improved, air pollution's gone down, they've got happier, less unequal cities. So I think that was the most difficult issue we were wrestling with.
I always like to try and conclude these conversations on notes of optimism, partly because the challenges are so great and can be so paralyzing. And yet there is such a remarkable network of people and leaders, as exemplified by yourself, who are doing things. So tell us one of, I'm sure, dozens of things that leave you feeling optimistic, something that should give us hope.
I have to say, when you were saying what a wonderful job you had, I have to say, I was thinking, well, hang on a minute, I've got a pretty good one, because I spend my life meeting incredibly inspiring people showing how we can find a way out of climate change while tackling social inequality at the same time. And I think that's absolutely what gives me hope that we can get there. So to give you one example, I met this amazing guy from India. He trained as a government official, was so disappointed by constantly being asked to take bribes that he left. Because he left a government job, his wife stormed out of him on him, his father threw him out of the house, and he found himself sitting on the road talking to the people driving rickshaws. The more he talked to them, the more he understood their world. He today runs an incredibly successful company with electric rickshaws, which the rickshaw owners, the rickshaw drivers, come to own themselves for the first time ever. Mostly they work in absolute bondage all their lives and never get to own the rickshaws. And he'd shown that you can have women owning and driving electric rickshaws, so tackling inequality and climate change at the same time. And it's people like that that just absolutely give me the hope that we can get there. My favourite quote is from the great Indian novelist Arundhati Roy, and she said, "Another world is possible. And sometimes, when it's really quiet, I can almost hear her breathing."
Amazing. What a lovely, lovely note upon which to end. So thank you for everything that you have done up to now and for all the things that you will do in the future. And we're delighted to have you here at
The Conduit. Thank you, Paul, for the joy that is The Conduit Club and the fun that we can have here meeting so many other people tackling these really difficult issues together.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations, produced in partnership with Bloomberg Businessweek. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. For more information on The Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com. To learn more about Bloomberg Businessweek, please visit businessweek.com.